We begin the hour by welcoming in, as we do each Tuesday at this time, our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
What is up, Mr. Kimball?
Well, just forging ahead as we do here. I was checking out the website this afternoon. You've been very busy getting some updates on that. I have a great bias and preference for the on-air tab, but lots of good stuff at ColinFlemingLit.com.
It's depressing where this all stands, isn't it? Between you and me, as we talk in front of people, it's bad, right? See that email today?
Oh yeah, you have got some. I'm going to say some people out there that really don't want you to succeed, no matter what.
It's really hard to imagine somebody more openly hated, isn't it? I mean, you see it. I've shared these emails with you for a while now. You saw the Guggenheim thing the other day. I mean, I can imagine you as somebody who is previously not really experienced in this world. I mean, now you are. Now you know what's going on. But can you imagine, like, if I had just thrown stuff like that out there with you right away when we first met? Like, you have to kind of ramp up the speed, right? I mean, have you ever seen anything so blatantly bigotry-oriented and disturbing? Like, how deep this goes?
What I don't understand in all of it is it would seem to be bad business, or has the publishing industry done such a good job of embracing mediocrity that they know what they have will sell, even if it's largely crap?
Rich, and I don't know if I've ever even used your Christian name before, but that's how serious I am. I think if their children had cancer and I had the cure to save their children, I think these people hate me so much they'd let their children die, and I'm not being hyperbolic. I think they have such a built-in... I think I'm the devil to these people. I am everything they are not. You know, you mentioned that website. It's like, think about something like this. I counted today. You saw this in the email. I've written more than 250 short stories in less than 3 years. That website, that blog, which is up around 1,000 entries now, if you parcel that out into books, I did the math today, that's 50 books, 34 op-eds, all of the art pieces. This is by somebody who's blackballed in an industry, who is producing like multiple books per week, who is by any definition, because I back it up, the leading expert in the world on like how many dozen different things is it? And it just leads to more resentment. And what I spend most of my life doing is writing these bigots. You can't, if I died and I left you in possession of my email, it's hard to even give someone a sense for what it looks like every day. If you went into the sent folder, you'd think he must have been 500 different men at once. How is this even humanly possible? And the more I achieve, the more they loathe me. And it's like, I have to give up drinking. I have to run up a hill. Today I've covered 7 miles, of course. I had to take coins to the Star Market today twice so I could afford to buy birthday gifts for my niece. I mean, these people are just, they're killing me, man. But to the radio.
There is some good news, though, and I'm excited and looking forward to reading the Sam Cooke book, which is getting closer to being a reality.
Yes, I saw it for the first time. The way it's really going to look when it comes out yesterday, I was quite nervous because there were no edits and there was no back and forth. And I know this will ultimately make more problems for me. People out there, and they might know this if they read the blog, there's actually a nationwide embargo in this country on reviewing my book, with the New York Times as a policy, the Washington Post as a policy, even though I've written for all these places. That's how deep this goes. It's not that I've done anything to these people, but now you're going to have really kind of like this ultimate book of the civil rights movement. So it's about African-American history written by a white guy, and that'll give them more reason to suppress it and hate me. And I wrote the book in 15 days. I wrote the Scrooge book in 13 days. It's not a human pace, but I'm looking at the thing yesterday. I'm thinking, my God, this is the best music book I've ever seen. And what that does now at this point is it depresses the hell out of me, because I wish I could say this could be a lot better. No wonder you're here in this particular position. But I read it and it's like, but you've seen all the stories. It's not like, well, that one's a big drop off. They're all the same, but all entirely stylistically different. But yeah, this Sam Cooke book for Bloomsbury, this 33 1/3 book, it's good. And it'll actually be in bookstores.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Well, let's see, where to begin in our weekly conversation. How about walking etiquette. What have you got to tell me about that, and am I doing it the right way?
Oh, I always assume you do most things in this life the right way, Mr. Kimball. You are a paragon and Polaris that we all look to for guidance, and I'm sure that's no different in ambulation. And I was thinking to myself, I'm probably going to sound like a dick talking about this, but you can probably hear my voice right now. I don't even really care that much, but I walk a lot. Obviously, it's something that I've had to do for various reasons, even just to keep going. And I have noticed the faux pas that people make when walking. And they're not significant things, obviously. I mean, of all the things to gripe about in this cesspool of a world right now, it's not like the etiquette of walking. But the little things, they can sometimes add up. And so I would start, very basic rule. And I would have thought it was kind of understood, but it's really not. It's just like driving. It's just like driving in America. It's not like driving in England. Right side of the road, people. Right, Kimball?
Well, although, isn't it suggested that as a pedestrian, if you're walking in the road, that you walk on the left side so you can see the oncoming traffic?
Okay, yes. And so you're getting highly technical. It's how skilled you are with the whole walking thing. And I will often, like on Hanover Street here in the North End, which you probably know, maybe got some cannolis or something, you have to take to the street because the sidewalk will just take too long as you walk behind these convoys of people. That's another issue.
Yes.
No human convoys, people. No flotillas. Look that word up if you don't know it. And so I'm counting the sidewalk as the actual road. And we've disagreed before because you're anti-injury and I'm pro-injury in some ways. I feel like if you're on the sidewalk and it's an able-bodied man and they're on the wrong side and their head is down, you are free to keep going and pop them.
I'm actually good with that, as a matter of fact, because here's what I don't like. My pet peeve when it comes to walking, and I walk a lot, not as much as you, but I walk a lot, especially in the summertime, the stop-and-gawkers, the people who just will stop and plant themselves in the middle of the sidewalk. No, it's called a sidewalk for a reason. If you want to look at something, get out of my way.
We've talked about supermarket space eaters.
Oh.
They have their cousin of the sidewalk, too, where you can be out really early in the morning, unlike ComAv or something here in Boston. And somebody will be over that middle line, and they'll be almost like angling you into the road, where the road is just the cars that are parked up. So
right.
Like, they're twisting an ankle. And it's almost like that person at the movie theater who is like, this place is pretty empty. Think I'll grab the seat next to you, big fella.
Yeah.
And you're thinking like, oh, dear, hands out of the pockets. Here comes trouble. Be ready to defend yourself. And so you have to deal with those people. Then you have the zigzaggers.
Mm.
This has gotten worse with the phone, where you're trying to gauge their route as they're in front of you. They're almost like some inebriate person staggering to and fro. And you can kind of think, oh, it's Dublin. And it's like, I'm in Ulysses by Joyce, but you're not. You're just behind like some street urchin. And today I was, it's like when you see a forward come down the ice on Charlie McAvoy, and like McAvoy kind of angles the guy to the boards, and like that window of passage gets smaller and smaller and smaller. That can happen too, inadvertently, when you're walking behind someone. So someone would have the angle on me today. And they were somebody who was PDB, which is my politically correct term. I'm going to premiere it right now for pretty damn beefy. And they had me angled, Kimball.
Oh.
And I thought I could squeeze through the gap.
Yeah.
And they clocked me up against the boards. Like Jack Edwards would have been, oh, he's fallen by the kick plate, which is a term I had never heard before in my entire hockey life until Jack Edwards said it like a dozen times a game. So these are some of the things that I am not particularly keen on as a walker.
Well, we're on the same page on many of those, and I suspect we will be on this one. I was not aware of this until you brought it to my attention, but apparently back in the early 50s, somebody decided to take one of the more despicable characters in fiction, Harry Lime, and build a whole radio series around him.
Yes, I think it's I think it's 52 episodes all together. So anyone who's seen The Third Man knows that Harry Lime is killed at the end. He's not just killed at the end. Like, pretty remarkable how he goes out. He is executed by his best friend after he gives him this knowing nod to say, put a bullet in my brain. Mm. Like, I'm that despicable and my time is really up here. And The Third Man, it's funny because we think of this Orson Welles, Harry Lime character is so ingratiating. He's so charming. And he doesn't come into the film until you're like 70 minutes in or whatever it is. That great entrance with one of the only times that like a cat has a good usage when it crawls over to Orson Welles and it causes like the light to go on. And Joseph Cotten's like, wait, that's my dead buddy over there, but he must be alive. What's going on? But like, for all of the charm of Orson Welles in this film, he's really kind of like the most evil character. He's one of them in all of certainly mid-century cinema, because what he does is, on the black market, he dilutes penicillin and he murders and deforms children, which is up there.
That's bad, yes.
So the whole notion of this radio show, The Lives of Harry Lime, is Welles comes on and he says, you know that I got, there's like a gunshot. So it's like the execution gunshot. It's like, you know that I got killed at the end of The Third Man, but this is what happened to me before then. And it's a much lighter tone. And he goes around and he's suave and he's charming. He's kind of this lovable rogue. He's sort of the character that Orson Welles himself would play, like if you catch an interview with him on The Dick Cavett Show.
Speaking of which, for those people who only know Welles as perhaps that guy wearing his smock or whatever he would dress in late in life, and that's all the Orson Welles you know, then they've probably seen on YouTube the video of him and the outtakes of him trying to do the, I think it was Paul Masson wine commercial, We Will Sell No Wine Before It's Time. And the idea has become a certified urban legend that Welles was drunk, but that's not quite the whole story.
Did you ever knock back some Paul Masson wine in your time?
You know, I may have back in the day. I certainly regret it now because I'm sure I couldn't have enjoyed it.
I looked it up, and they went out of business in like, I think if I'm remembering correctly, it was like the early 70s. My sister had asked me, she's like, are they still around doing their thing? So this is kind of depressing. The like number one searched on thing for Orson Welles, you create all these works of art, right?
Right.
You're this raconteur and this interesting person. The number one searched on thing for Orson Welles is this drunk commercial. And I'm sure you would know this, and I'm sure you always thought this too, that there was something else to this story. So in the commercial, Orson Welles is not the outtakes for the commercial, the takes they didn't use. He's not doing well. He's flubbing his lines. He's slurring. He's practically falling asleep in his chair. And people like to laugh at him over this, which I find typical and not surprising. I think a lot of people resented Welles because he was, I mean, I identify with it. He was a lot smarter than other people. And there were people who were always out to get him when he was the boy wonder or when he was this kind of Zaftig fellow later on in life. And the charge was that he was just so drunk out of his mind. But it doesn't jive with Welles and his work ethic and how much he was doing every day. So, like, recently there was an interview with the director of this commercial, and he said that Welles had been in Las Vegas the night before shooting. So it must have been the other side of the wind, probably.
Right.
And he came down in the limo, and he was going to sleep in the limo because Welles was, like, a maximum efficiency guy. And it's like me, like grabbing like the granola bar, like in between walking to the Starbucks to get another coffee, and that's all I eat type of thing. And so he took the sleeping pill and didn't kick in until he got to the studio to shoot this commercial. And they tried to do it. So that's all it was to try to do it to get him out of there. And then he went off and he had a nap. And like 3 hours later, he came back out and he was his usual self with this wine commercial. It's funny listening to him hawk this wine, because I'm sure it was, like, pretty terrible. And the way it was talked about in the copy was that you were just having, like, the ultimate wine from, like, some French vineyard. And he would always change the copy, saying, you have a nice little cheap rot-gut wine to get drunk on. let's rein this in. So he was sort of had that reputation for being difficult to work with, even on this. But sometimes he had a buddy of his who was a cinematographer who worked with him a lot later in life, and the guy shot porn films.
Right.
Wells comes over. He's like, no, this isn't how you mount a woman from behind in the shower. It's like maximum lighting and coverage and everything. And he's directing like the shower.
Yeah, and even helped him edit some of it, right?
Yes, because and that's so in keeping with Wells' belief that cinema really comes to life in the editing process, and really the rhythm of editing. Like, somebody who wanted to, who knew their stuff, could write a dissertation on the relationship between something like jazz and Orson Welles in music and his editing style, because there's actually a lot of overlap. So he was just one of those people who, I mean, it's like if I see somebody and they've written something and they're like 10 or whatever, and we're talking like a relative or whatnot, it's hard for me not to point out like a little kind of interesting thing about a sentence. It's like, okay, if you take this word here and you move it back forward, see what that does, and you get that like look on their face that you're sharing with them something they're not going to know on their own, that opens up stuff that they can know on their own. And it's like that sort of teaching, pure teaching moment of somebody who loves their art, or really who is their art. So yeah, that was definitely Wells.
I had a lovely lunch today at school, and yeah, part of it was my quinoa and my veggies and my selection of different nuts that I like to eat at lunch, but mostly because I listened to this wonderful recording you sent me of the Beatles rehearsing at the Cavern Club. And it, first of all, the audio quality was so much better than I would have expected. But the band, they sounded so good. And this was, I was trying to think, this must have been Stu Sutcliffe playing with them, right?
No.
No?
No, it was not. This is, it's funny because it's actually going to be, to me it's surprising, the transformation from when this recording was made to how tight they can sound a little while after. Because you're right, it sounds in some ways like it's the Quarrymen, but it is the Beatles right on the verge of fame. So it's September 1962, and to set the timeline for people, and I'm writing about this in the Beatles book I'm working on, they have gotten Ringo Starr in the drummer's chair, replacing Pete Best the month before, in August. Love Me Do is going to come out and reach, number 17 in the charts in October, because their manager, Brian Matthews, buys up 10,000 copies of it. They are having their quasi-audition at Parlophone Records with George Martin doing Besame Mucho in early September. But it's somewhere in September that they're at their home base. Now, I like that they're at the Cavern Club and they have it sort of like after hours. It's like your buddies and you on the hockey team and you kind of have the rink to yourself, or the sub shop where you all hang out like after hours and they're letting you stay there and have like another chicken parm type of thing. And so, like, they wouldn't have had I Saw Her Standing There, which is one of the numbers here. It's called 17 at the time, when they were with Stuart Sutcliffe. So Sutcliffe is quite dead by this point. McCartney's on bass. It's the lineup that you know. And so they play I Saw Her Standing There, first of all. And I'm sure you noticed the very sort of incongruous harmonica part by John Lennon, which they dispensed with.
Yes. Yeah, I also loved, they did a couple versions of, was it One After 909? And then, Was it Raunchy, the instrumental they did a couple times at the end?
No, it was a song called Cat's Walk. So first they do, like you said, One After 909 twice. And they're going to revisit that song on March 5th, 1963. That's how bunched the timeline is. They're doing Thank You Girl that day and One After 909, and I know we brought this up one time, a long time ago, when George Harrison solos on One After 909 at that March 5th session the next year, John Lennon goes, what kind of solo was that? Because it sounds like he's playing a rubber band. And it's like, listening to this rehearsal, you could think to yourself, what did you expect, John? He's doing the rubber band thing on these solos too. The second version, you'll notice, of One After 909 is a lot tighter than the first. And if people want to do a comparison, listen to the 1969 version from the rooftop of One After 909 when they're doing the whole Get Back thing and ends up being Let It Be. Listen to the guitar solo on that. It's one of the best guitar solos of the 1960s. But the last number was a Paul McCartney number, and it was called Catswalk. And if you think about it, it's the whole idea of the visual pairing with the music, because it has this kind of arabesque guitar figure played by George Harrison, because McCartney's on bass, of like a cat walking along, like an alley cat, the Tom, late of Tom and Jerry, walking along the top of a fence, going up and down, like the shadow, right? Up and down. And shadow is a key word, because it's very much a riff on The Shadows.
Cliff Richard, yeah.
So when they were in Germany, they did this instrumental, and Harrison's quite similar. It was called Cry for a Shadow. And they gave Harrison a co-writing credit because he played the guitar part. They didn't know. They thought, like, okay, the person who plays the solo gets credit for, like, writing part of the song. That's obviously not how it works. So it's them, like, right there doing their thing, and they're going to be back in Hamburg one more time in December through the end of the year to New Year's Eve. And they didn't want to be there. They wanted to be in Liverpool at the Cavern, reaping the success of Love Me Do and building on that. So it's them trying to tighten up the sound.
Yeah, it's great. You can hear that they are right there on the cusp. Check it out on YouTube, Beatles rehearsing at the Cavern Club in 1962. Colin Fleming, check out the new and improved website, colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog as well. Colin, we appreciate it, and we'll visit again next week.
Okay, sounds good, sir.